somewhat suitable second choice to Tony, who was invited to give a talk, and he gives a 5-minute video, and I'll try to round out the rest of the 45 minutes here. This talk will be hopefully free of all chemistry, because I know very little about it. Probably everybody else in the room knows more than I. So I'm going to go off on a slightly different tangent, talking about derived semantics. But to set the stage for that a little bit, no chemistry, just semantics. About a year ago, Tony Hay and some of my other colleagues at Microsoft Research put this opinion piece in CACM talking about the notion of a smart cyber infrastructure. And Henry, you just touched on this as well, about the sort of interconnectedness of this. And this is notable, I think, for one key thing is that this is coming out of Microsoft. And I think a few years ago, you'd be hard-pressed to get this sort of an attitude about this sort of notion of linked open data as part of the scientific record being acknowledged by Microsoft. And hopefully that's what Tony Hay's organization and what we're trying to bring to the table here, not only in our collaborations externally with people like Creator Murray Rust, but the bulk of then the evangelism effort for us is then internally at Microsoft to get them to start listening to the changes that need to be made to a lot of our infrastructural tools and software that we're producing. A couple of the notions that come out of this paper are really the fact that with the vast amount of data that's being produced, semantics isn't just a cute or an interesting thing or a way to get access to the data, but it's actually going to be absolutely essential to provide this level of interconnectedness so that we get to the point where the robots, the machines, are able to query over, to reason over, to synthesize the scientific record. A lot of the things that go into that paper find their genesis in one of our late colleagues, Jim Gray, who was partnered up with Tony when he came to Microsoft Research. And among the sort of long diatribe of principles that Jim Gray constantly pounded the table with, specifically the funding agencies, there's three that sort of come up and touch on some of the things that we've talked about today. And this was the environment that I came into at Microsoft Research. I joined the team about just under 3 years ago today, really with the view of what are the things that we can do with respect to creating larger repositories of content? How can we change the paradigm for authoring and publication models? We haven't done much in the publication models yet. And what can we do to start facilitating the notion of data libraries where extracted and published data can get exposed and get reused? And in that same vein, a few years ago, we started up something called the Jim Gray Award. The latest winner of that, Phil Bourne, as you'll see in the program, Peter and Cameron and I are all taking off tomorrow to Phil Bourne's lab at UC San Diego, where we're going to be talking about the future of the research object of the future at this Beyond the PDF conference. And one of the things that Phil has been hammering about is the fact that the current publication model is too damn slow. It's too difficult to turn the crank on the research cycle when it takes 18, 24 months to go from authorship and submission into a publication that can get reused by somebody else. And I'm recycling his slides here, but what I really like is that he touched upon some of the things that can be done or need to be done right now in order for us to accelerate the rate of scientific discovery. And in the slide, he's color-coded them. What things he thinks are easy, what are medium, and what are hard. And just to call out two of these, that data and the knowledge derived from that data are distinct and not easily navigated does not make sense to me. Is a biological database really different than a biological journal? And so it's this notion of adaptment, the notion of the data traveling along with the document that I think was the impetus for what were Peter's ideas for taking the authoring process of a chemical document and embedding the chemical data and chemical structures within that document. And toward the latter half, I'll start getting onto the sort of notion of reward systems. Phil calls out the fact that author disambiguation is one of the key constraints, not to mention the reward system, but being able to link up with an individual the totality of their scholarly record, not just the published articles, but published data sets, created software, and other contributions to the record of science. And that's one of the areas that we're starting to explore a little bit right now. So at one end of the spectrum, we have this notion of how can we change the paradigms of things that are being created so that they are semantically accurate, so they carry the data along with them from the outset. And two projects here that I'll mention just briefly, I said there'd be no chemistry, are the Chem for Word project and ORE Chem. And then I'll segue into this notion of derived semantics. So I first met Peter in a pub. Kirkland. Notice a trend here? Actually, it wasn't a pub. It was a bar at a restaurant where we were having dinner. But it was just under 3 years ago today. And I think to that point, you had had a number of conversations with Tony Hay about this idea of getting a CML, chemical authoring, into Word documents. And so after our first meeting, this is PDF. You'll forgive me, Peter. But PDF is a good mock-up tool in this case. And I put these together, just cutting and pasting pictures out of Wikipedia. And this was the proto-spec, before we even had any spec here at all. I don't think any of us have looked at them since about May of 2008, so I thought I'd throw them back in. But the notion was, I want to be able to click on a button and import chemistry into a document and not have that be a picture, but actually having that be a view over the data. I want to create my own CML files if I have a separate application. I want to come in, I want to click, and I want to import CML. Click that. Browse to a CML file, say that's it, and I put that into my document. Or I want to use a web service to look things up. So I have a search box in the ribbon at the top, I type something, I get some search results back from the web, that's the one I like, and I insert that into my document. This took me about 45 minutes to put together because I'm cutting and pasting a whole bunch of pictures together. Do come to the demos later today. Joe Townsend will give you a demo of what this looks like circa 3 years later. And all of this and more is working. We've got full chemical editing capabilities inside of Word. In between me putting together that PowerPoint and what we've produced now, there were a lot of meetings. Probably about 75% of the time was Peter teaching chemistry to somebody who hadn't had chemistry since high school. But we got to the vision very early on, and then it was all the technical goo of getting it all working within Word. And where we ended up was at ACS last year in March. We released the beta version of the chemistry add-in for Word, or Chem for Word for short. To date, we have had... Whew, that's nice. I have time slides. To date, we have had 250,000 downloads of this add-in. And as of next week, we are going to release version 1. Joe's going to push the button and push this out, version 1 of this. And it will also be available under an Apache open source license on CodePlex. So that's one project. Another project that we've been working on, also with Peter, as well as, I'm going to risk going back into slide mode here, as well as with others at a number of universities, is the ORE Chem project, which is exploring ways that we can take a number of ontologies, a chemistry ontology, an experimental ontology where you define your experimental plan and also the results of a given run of an experiment, document ontology, and reaction ontologies, and be able to bring all these things together as a way of recording the process of chemical experiments. Simon is here with us today, so if anybody wants to learn more about the ORE Chem project, I invite you to speak with him. So that's a couple of, as I said, a couple of efforts that start at the one end of the spectrum, which is how can we start developing tools that produce these things. And if you go back to the picture, the purpose as a spell checker, a grammar checker, are serving in Word. It helps you along, it guides you along the way, and you're hidden from the guts of that. But if you zoom back out now to the entirety of the World Wide Web, there are billions of documents. And the question then becomes, what is it that we can start extracting from the documents on the web? And this is a project that's being led out of one of our research teams in Asia, that is using machine learning and using entity extraction to look over the corpus of literature, sorry, the corpus of documents on the web, and starting to identify things like people, places, things, and to a lesser extent, the relationships between them. So just a quick walkthrough of what this looks like. If I type in something like Unilever Center into the tool today, it will come back with a set of results here, and you can see some of the warts in it here. Found this Russian guy named Peter Murray Rostov that it thinks is a person, and other things like science informatics, which it actually thinks is a person here as well. But these are people that it's found related to the concept, related to the entity Unilever Center, and it's showing some of the pages where these things are coming from. It's then tracking, again, a very lightweight notion of relationship in that if I pick any one of these people that are related to Peter Murray Rust, related here in this context means they have been found on the same web page together, and the ranking is the number of occurrences there. And you can drill down into any one of these things, you can navigate to other people, you can see the pages that they were linked to together, but it's a very lightweight say saying there's a relationship between these two entities. Also doing work in being able to extract types of statements out of the web. So biographical statements about Peter Murray Rust, things that are coming from, you know, probably submissions to conferences where he's had to provide bio information or maybe out of Wikipedia and things like that. We can start pulling out biographical information, checking in social networks, see if we have a match there, and that's definitely Peter Murray Rust. Recognize the bear suit?
Poaching, I think.
Yeah, probably. And as well as quotes, and being able to quote's pretty easy to identify, but there's still some logic there that needs to be sussed out of the human text out of a document. And then you can start looking at some interesting timeline information, especially when you get back into, for example, the extent to which the XML lists were documented. You would see those show up here on various listservs that have been indexed and surfaced over time. Okay, so that's interesting at sort of a high level, at a very high level. What are the facts and entities that we can extract out of the web? I'm going to skip publication for a second because I'm going to come back to that one. But you can also look at these same relationships graphically if you want to. You can see, you know, here's the cloud of people in the Peter Murray Rust realm. They're grouped by their relationships to each other as well. Or you can go into a 6 degrees of association effect here, and you can put in two people's names and see how these people are connected. So interesting ways of sort of navigating this entity relationship on the web. This is a free tool. You can go and play with it on the web. It's at entitycube.research.microsoft.com. Love to get your feedback, but it's an ongoing research project in that respect. And sort of full stop. Humor me for a second as we get off the topic, both of chemistry and of semantics, and I want to talk about another project by way of example, something that I think is becoming increasingly interesting to me right now. So one of the problems that the Wikipedia folks have been having is the disproportionate amount of coverage of Wikipedia articles that exist in languages other than English. You get English language articles, I think it's German, and a couple of other languages, and then you have this sort of long tail where if you look at any other language, there's very little article coverage. And so they've been trying to open up the platform, make it easier for people to create new articles, versions of articles that already exist in English or German in those other languages. And so we worked with them to develop a tool built on some of our machine translation technology. And the reason that this becomes interesting is, okay, on the one hand, it makes it very easy to do the following. I can open up Wikipedia, I can navigate to an article, I can say, here's this article in English, and if the article existed in other languages, you'd see that over on the nav pane here. So the article about Peter Murray Rust exists right now only in English. I can invoke the Wikibasha, which is just a toolbar, not even a toolbar, just a shortcut add-in, and it says, okay, what language would you like to create an article in? I pick Greek. If I was doing this correctly, I might transliterate Peter Murray Rust into Greek characters. It will check to see if one of those articles already exists and link it up. If it doesn't, it will create a stub article. And from there, I can now take the machine-translated version of the English language article, get the machine translated version of it, and now I can start editing this article directly. So I can highlight any line, I can see the English and how that was translated. If anybody else has supplied another translation of that same sentence, those will be options for me to select here as well. But more critically, if it is a poor translation, I can edit the translation that the machine translation algorithms gave to me, and I can correct it in line here, and back up, and click publish, and I now have the article without ever having to learn the Wikipedia syntax for linking, without having to really write anything from scratch. It makes it very easy for somebody to create a new article. The thing that is fascinating to me, however, in this environment, is that when the user goes in and corrects that machine-translated version of that sentence here, those translations feed back into the entire machine translation algorithm. So you're creating this nice environment here where you're starting from something that we can sort of do pretty well, but not great with technology today, as a bootstrapping mechanism. You're making it then easy for people to modify it, change it, edit it, and change thirdly, change the way that the next time the translation happens, the quality of those translations. And I think this is a great example. So if you take Entity Cube, where we can sort of do things, but you still get Peter Murray Rustoff and other things, it's not perfect, and sort of take this notion of crowdsourcing, but it's not really crowdsourcing, and you apply that to the bibliographic record, you start getting something I think that's very interesting. So this project is something where we've taken what started as taking not all the content on the web, but you crawl the web and you say, is this an academic research paper? It's another case of entity recognition and machine learning. Is it a PDF? Does it have certain characteristics? Yes, it's a research paper. We're actually starting to backfill that now with actually real data sets from the IEEE and ACM. And this is mostly focused on the moment on the computer science literature, but we're about to expand that out substantially. Which I just said, there you go. And if you think about the way that bibliometrics happens, citation analysis happens today, it's very similar to the structure of the web. You have this document cites, or this document points to this document via an href in the web, or this paper cites this paper. And it's a very simple graph, and yet a number of things have been done with that. You can start building up certain levels of co-author graphs or h-index. You can start ranking papers on the importance within a field. David Shotton, who was mentioned earlier, has also proposed this notion of a citation typing ontology, where instead of saying this paper cites this paper, you can say this paper agrees with this paper, this paper disagrees with it, or any number of the parodies, plagiarizes, qualifies, quotes from relationships that exist in that. But even without that, and this would be fantastic if we could get to the stage, even without that, if you take the current corpus of literature and you apply some of these machine learning and entity extraction techniques to it, you can do pretty good. You can do some interesting things here. So this really started as an effort to say, how well can we do at finding the authors? Given the hamburger of a PDF, can we at least find the things that are authors? It's a bunch of strings. And now can we start doing things to say, yes, Peter Murray Rust and P. Murray Rust are the same, and J. Murray Rust is a different person, or A. Wade and Alex Wade and Alex D. Wade are the same person, by looking not just at the relationship between this paper and the author, but looking at the entire graph of co-authorship and domains and other things. So authorship is a big area of getting back to what Phil Warren was saying about having an author identifier system. We can do the same thing then with journals. If I'm looking at a citation within a PDF and I get an abbreviated journal name, how can I start bringing these things together as being a single entity with relationships between them, as with conferences, as with the organization that a particular author comes from? And then using different sets of technology, how can we start auto-categorizing these things? How can we say this particular paper falls into the area of computer vision and this paper falls into the area of computer security? All right? So very, very simple graph here. But this graph starts from a set of PDFs where there's hamburger, and we're trying to make slightly less dead cows out of it. Okay, so this tool is available today. There's only right now, like I said, about 7.5 million records in this, but that's going to be growing quite a bit. And what I was going to do is a demo here, but I just saw a second ago that my... it says I'm connected. Okay. So let me jump into a quick demo and show you a little bit about what this looks like. So I said primarily computer science, but we do have a lot of other papers and people and institutions in all domains. And one of the things that we do to build up this corpus of found documents over the web is that whenever we find a PDF, we're not just doing entity extraction on the authors and the journals and the conferences, but we also do entity extraction on the set of citations that are in that document. So if I'm looking at a PDF, and you go to the end of the PDF, and you find each one of the citations, we then explode that into a record in the database as well. So I can come in here, and I can do a search for Peter Murray Rust. And I gotta put my hat back. Beautiful. Bear with me 1 second. Oops, lots of time. Doesn't want me to do it.
Yeah.
The browser.
All the other copies.
Cannot handle multiple sessions. I'm logging somewhere else.
I wasn't just picking up either.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be bold, and I'm going to make watch me type this in. Oh, yeah, beautiful. Click here. Great. Do not like that. Isn't technology wonderful? Keep this window open? Okay. kill all browsers.
We've all been around this hour.
Right? I'm not giving
it's
up.
It's a recursive...
I'm not giving up. Nobody else has done a live demo today, and I'm going to do it. I insist. It really is worth waiting for. Okay. So we'll try that one more time. Peter Murray Rust. Okay, so as I showed on the graph, I have the relationships now stored in here. At a very high level, summary level, you see Peter, you see his association, you see the number of publications, the number of citations, some computed things like the G-index and H-index. You can also sort of see the cumulative number of publications and citations over time. So as of about 2004, citation graph went up, or if I want to look, this is cumulative, if I want to look at it from an annual perspective as well, I can start seeing the frequency over time of the citations and publications. I can now drill down in, and again, this is probably not going to be complete across the chemistry literature, but you get the idea, the publications, or if I want to look at the articles that have been cited, his articles, I can do that as well. But you can then also surface some of the other things, like the co-authors that Peter's had, the conferences that these papers come out of, the journal publications that these come out of as well. Or if I want to look at these things, the United Nations give me money. If I want to look at these things graphically, I can do the same sort of graphical navigation of these entities as I did, as I showed with EntityCube. So this is the co-author graph that shows Peter in the middle. Zoom out a little bit. Other authors within the system that he's authored papers with. The proximity is the number of papers. So if I drag Henry to the side here, click on this edge. I can see the number of papers that they've authored together. I can click on the edge to browse into that set of information. Or, again, 6 degrees type of thing. If I want to look at two people and see how they're related to each other, you can do that same level of navigation. That's at the author level. But you can also go back out and drill into the same information at the publication level or at the conference level. And another example of trying to extract some of the semantics from the existing web information is saying, okay, what happens a lot of times in the literature is you'll see things where a call for papers is existing. Can we turn that into a calendar of call for papers information and allow that somebody to go in and say, I want to look at the particular this hypertext ACM conference on hypertext and when the call for papers for that conference is going to be. Where was I going with this? Same thing for organizations. So if I want to see what the top organizations are in a particular area, let's drill into something like artificial intelligence across all years, and I see a ranking of the universities in this particular domain of computer science. We're playing around with our own algorithms here. This is different from some of the other sort of PageRank algorithms where it's all based on a number of incoming links, and we parcel out what are citations that are coming from other papers within that domain, which boost the rank of that paper higher. So it's not strictly a count perspective. And if I want to drill in again on a subset of that information, Oxford beats Cambridge here. But again, if I want to focus now on the last 10 years, or the last 5 years, or how are we doing in another area of life? look at that. Okay, so you get the idea. And so this is very simple things that starting from hamburgers and starting then to create some sense of meaning out of that literature. Finally, the last thing, bringing this back to the notion of Wikibasha, what is the community participation model? So right now we're crawling the web, we're trying to go out and get extra data sets. Where somebody has made available an individual paper on the web, you will see a download link to it on the site. So there's four copies of this that are available on the open web. But how can you get involved? How can people participate in this project? And what we have is, let me go back to Peter Murray-Rust, an edit button that we bake into this. And we do require at the moment that people log into this so that we can track where the contributions are coming from, try to prevent spam. This is not at the moment automatically updating the database. This is going into a queue that we, Mechanical Turk, we crowdsource a little bit more to make sure that we're doing a secondary check on it. But allows you to do a number of things. It would allow me to go in and say that Alex Wade and Alex D. Wade are the same person, or this other Alex Wade who wrote something on ophthalmology is not me. So I can merge authors together. I can split authors apart. I can start uploading my own content. So I can provide a PDF that goes directly into our indexing engine or a BibTeX file if I want to do that. And the same thing about information on a paper. The nice thing about this, in the same way that the nice thing about Wikibasha is that it feeds back into the machine translation algorithms, is that all of the data that the end users are supplying then feeds back into the entity extraction algorithms that we use as we troll through the web and we find new documents. And so we're building up what I hope is a very nice sort of self-healing ecosystem. And as more and more people provide their documents in here, it provides another avenue for serving not only the bibliographic data about the information, but also access to the PDFs, the author supply of PDFs as well. So I welcome your feedback. I would love to hear your opinions on it, playing around with it. The last thing that I will mention, if you don't tell anybody about this because it's secret, is we're not being recorded, are we? is that we are right now in the process of releasing a set of open APIs into this data set as well. So people will be able to go in and write their own applications that query against this data. You'll be able to pull down all the forms of authorship and essentially build up your own authority file. These APIs are going to be announced over the next few weeks. I'd love for people to play with them. I'd love for people to give us feedback on what would make them more useful and how we can start having this build up in support of open scholarship and open bibliographic data. All right, thank you all very much.
Okay, so we've got time for a couple of questions. While the technical jiggery pokery required for the next session and everyone starts lining up.
We're lunch after this, aren't
we? Nope, we've got the Patrick Gooch session.
Oh, actually, right after this, pretty good.
Rufus.
So, are you doing mic?
I'm doing the mic.
So these... Dr. Rufus Pollock, Open Knowledge Foundation. So the question I have, it's amazing, great apps. What is the... one of the things I always sit here and say is people, you know, can conceive of these things. They look lovely doing it. For years, the issue always was getting data to do it. So you've got all this data you're pulling into your system. Are you releasing that data back as open data into the community, the bibliographic data? And how are you getting it? Are you having to purchase it? Are you just scraping it and going, come sue us? Or no? And genuinely, I guess the question I also have to ask a bit deep, if it's not open data, why are we encouraging anyone to go and crowdsource data for free into what's going to be a closed ecosystem? I mean, unless there's a commitment to open up the bibliographic data, it's really bad to encourage people to go and for free do work to improve what will then become a valuable data set to someone else.
And that's a number of things that we're going to be working on. I would love to hear your ideas for what would make that the most useful way of publishing that data out. We are venturing into other avenues. So one of the things that my colleague Evelyn has done is taken a lot of ngram data from indexed web data and started to make this available. And it took us, in that case, it took us months of query log data to ngrams on the published web simply to sanitize the information in a way that made our lawyers happy with the level of PII that was in that. So in this case, I don't expect us having that same level of issue. We'll see how that goes.
But just, so is there a commitment to say you will be doing whatever you can to make some parts of that data set open? So for example, any data set that's being generated, so A, are you making an effort to identify clearly in your data set data that you're proprietarily buying in? Two, when you scrape data, that can be deep trouble. If you're just scraping data off the web and going, hey guys, well, it's open, that's just not the case, right? We all know that, right? If you're going and scraping IEEE's database of papers, that's proprietary data. So are you identifying data you're creating and crowdsourced data? Or not? Can you make a commitment now, right now, to say any data that's ever crowdsourced or any data that we're producing that hasn't got these kind of issues, we will commit to put out under an open license?
I can't make that commitment without my lawyers coming and hitting me on the head with a hammer. But you have my commitment that that's absolutely the goal of this project. And where it gets into an interesting dance is where we are. So for the most part, IEEE and ACM and others are very happy to have us provide extra traffic and extra ways of people getting into their content. And from that perspective, I don't see there being any issues at all. Where they will certainly, especially large publishers, where they will certainly have an opinion is whether or not we are directing traffic to the freely available one that somebody's put up on the web versus their paid one. But we're not preventing ourselves from providing access to those where they exist.
For example, I had a year discussion several years ago with Google about getting their data set, for example, behind Google Books, just the metadata, just the bibliographic data.
Yeah.
And it just ran into the ground. So I'm frequently counting, oh, yes, of course it will, and then you don't see it. So I guess it's that thing of, of course it should. Google are just scraping it for libraries. Shouldn't they want more traffic? But apparently not.